So, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the second of Stakeholder Forum's Countdown to the UN SDG Summit 2023 series of 8 webinars in the run-up to the September 2023 SDG Summit. With the support of experts, we aim to review until June 2023 2 goals each month, taking SDG 17 as a cross-cutting goal. The series will explore where we are in the implementation of the goals and identify transformative actions for change, interlinkages and trade-offs among goals and partnerships to accelerate implementation. The event has been organized by Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future. I'm Irena Zubcevic, Director of Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future and your host today from New York. I'm joined by today's moderator, Dr. David Horan, Assistant Professor at Trinity Business School, Trinity College Dublin, and advisor on SDG Partnerships and Governance for the SDGs for Stakeholder Forum, who joined us from Dublin. And as you can see on your screen, we have a panel of special guests who, with a diverse range of experiences and knowledge, will be introduced by David in the coming minutes. For those of you unfamiliar with Stakeholder Forum, it is an international non-for-profit NGO that has for more than 20 years been working to advance sustainable development at all levels, and you can find more information on our website. Before I present our speaker for introductory comments, there is a bit of housekeeping to attend to. Please note that the webinar is being live streamed on YouTube, and the link to the recording will be posted on the Stakeholder Forum website soon afterward, as has been the first one. You will have an opportunity to ask questions towards the end of the webinar, so please submit them to the Q&A section at the bottom of your screen, and our experts will reply to them. Please do not submit questions in the chat section. The chat section is for you to communicate with each other. You can post links there to matters relevant to the webinar topic and share contact details with each other if you wish to do so. You're welcome to scroll through the questions and vote for a question if you too would like it to be addressed. That will help us to select those that the panel can answer in the time we have. Apologies in advance for not being able to answer all questions due to time constraints. We begin today with introductory comments from Jan Gustav Strandenes, who is a senior advisor on governance at Stakeholder Forum. Jan Gustav, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Irina, for your introduction. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, friends, wherever you are on this earth. As Irina said, this is the second webinar on the SDG series of 8 monthly webinars, which will take us all the way up to the SDG summit at the UN next year in September. This time we focus on SDG 3 and SDG 4. And even though each SDG has been given an abbreviated title, we say, for instance, SDG 3 on health, it is well to remember that SDG's full title is Ensure Healthy Lives and Promote Well-being for All at All Stages. Simultaneously, while we ordinarily refer to SDG 4 as the one on education, its full title is Ensure Inclusive and Equitable Quality Education and Promote Lifelong Learning Opportunities for All. Each of these SDGs are supplied with 13 and 10 targets, respectively. Add to that, the 2 goals are supplied with 60 indicators. To repeat what we all know about the SDGs, this is what was negotiated and agreed to through a globally unanimous decision back in 2015. There are 17 goals, 169 targets, and 234 indicators. I give you this short background because it speaks to the interlinked and integrated nature of all SDGs. Their full titles also point to the variety of aspects and challenges in each SDG. The 2030 Agenda is the result of work that began in 1972, 50 years ago, with the establishment of the UN Environment Programme and the agreement to the Stockholm Declaration, which in principle one states that people have the fundamental right to freedom, equality, and adequate conditions of life in an environment of equality that permits a life of dignity and well-being, and people bear a solemn responsibility to protect and improve the environment for present and future generations. read the 24 principles of the 50-year-old Stockholm Declaration, and we see that everything we talk about today, and have done so for 50 years, was in fact already understood and identified back in 1972. Even though we have repeated these issues time and again, and each time with growing urgency, there is a huge difference today compared to the content of the 50-year-old Declaration. Today, we understand the problems, we have the money available, and we have the tools to rectify what has gone so desperately wrong for too many years. And the principal tools are the SDGs. A key purpose of this webinar series, aptly named the Countdown to the 2023 SDG Summit, is to promote the establishment of communities of practice that will continue to collaborate in the lead up to the summit and beyond. Another is to rekindle the will to implement the SDGs. In fact, we have higher ambitions than merely rekindle. We aim to energize the acceleration of this implementation through knowledge acquired since 2015, all well documented in the VNR reports from each of the HLPFs. And we use the communities of practice as incubators to innovative and forceful implementation of the 2030 agenda. Each of the SDGs are relevant to everybody and everything. Who is not concerned with health? What person has not benefited from education? Can we imagine a future without good health and proper education? As we are speaking today, negotiators and civil society are meeting in Montreal, Canada, at COP15 on biodiversity, negotiating a new plan to save the biodiversity of the world. By the 19th of December, they need to have an agreement. What may seem so simple, agree to save the world, is all the same a daunting task for negotiators. The UN Secretary General Guterres identified in simple terms what the negotiators and we all are up against. Nature is humanity's best friend, he said. Without nature, we have nothing and we are nothing. Nature is our life support system. And yet, he said, humanity seems hell-bent on destruction. Because we are waging war on nature, this conference, the COP15, is about the urgent task of making peace. And he continued, we need to address root causes of the destruction. Ecosystems, he said, have become playthings for profit. With our bottomless appetite for unchecked and unequal economic growth, humanity has become a weapon of mass extinction. And then he exclaimed, promises made must be promises kept. This is also our underlying philosophy, and we aim to shore up commitment, understanding and knowledge about the upcoming SDG summit and make sure we understand what accelerated implementation of the 2030 agenda means in real life. When we begin to formulate the outcomes for the upcoming SDG summit in September next year, we should also remember the ambitious agreements made at the 2019 SDG summit and keep in mind what Guterres said. Promises made must be promises kept. Let us make this the mantra for the upcoming summit. We cannot accomplish any of this without good health for all. We cannot comprehend how to develop solutions to the identified problems without good education. And this is what we will illuminate today. With good health for all living species and insightful education for all humans, I also wish you a happy Christmas and soon, I hope, a better year than the one we are soon leaving behind. Thank you for giving me the floor.
Okay. I'll jump in here. Thank you, Irena and Gustav, for your introductory comments. On behalf of Stakeholder Forum, I'd like to welcome everyone to our discussion of SDGs 3 and 4. It is great to have you all here. We have a great webinar in store for you and 9 excellent speakers for this discussion. First, each speaker will discuss the recommendations for accelerating the implementation of SDGs 3 and 4 in as holistic a way as possible. The speakers will each focus on those aspects of these goals most relevant to their expertise. We will then have a short reflection from Gervais and Zoa, former member of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. This will be followed by questions from the audience. Please feel free to post your questions in the Q&A box, and hopefully there will be time at the end to put some of your questions to our speakers. Before we hear from them, I will first introduce our speakers to everyone. First, you will hear from Dr. Wanda Marcotter, co-chair of the One Health High-Level Expert Panel and director of the Center for Viral Zoonosis at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. Second, we are delighted to have with us Dr. Londre Egbende, a medical doctor and public health specialist at Kinshasa School of Public Health and co-lead on the project Building Capacity for Sustainable Developments in Fragile States. Our third speaker is a leading researcher in One Health, Dr. Katie Pelican, principal investigator and developer of the One Health Systems Mapping and Analysis Toolkit at University of Minnesota. Fourth, we are very happy to introduce a leading advocate for inclusive education and local communities, Ms. Elizabeth Moses Mullard, principal advocate at Alpha Zulu Advocates and former member of the Independent Education Appeals Panel of the London Borough at Hillingdon. Fifth, we are delighted to have with us the esteemed Professor Victoria Thorson, a former UNESCO chair and director at the Collaborative Learning Center for Sustainable Development at the Inland Norway University. Our sixth speaker is a leader in education for the SDGs, Lucia Saner-Ju, Professor in Organization Development and Institutional Learning and President of the Center for Socioeconomic Development, also known as CSEND. Seventh, we are very happy to have with us the leading coordinator of training for climate change initiatives, Mr. Angus McKay, Director of the Division for Planet at UNITAR and head of the UNCC Learn Secretariat. Our eighth speaker is a political scientist and leader in development education, Dr. Karen Brown, Director of the Interdisciplinary Center for the Study of Global Change, co-chair of the Masters of Development Practice Program and co-lead of SDG initiatives at University of Minnesota. To finish off, we will hear from an expert in scaling education innovations in low and middle income countries, Mr. Brad Olson, senior fellow with the Center for Universal Education in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution. We are very grateful to have you all here and we look forward to your contributions. I would now like to give the floor to Dr. Wanda Marcotter. Wanda, given your esteemed position as co-chair of the One Health High-Level Expert Panel and your expertise in virology and transdisciplinary research, we will be grateful for your recommendations.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and thank you so much for this opportunity to be part of this forum. So I'm going to talk more from my role as co-chair of OLAP advising the quadripartite on health matters and specifically with a focus on prevention of pandemics. And we had some discussions before this forum and we thought it would be a good idea to go back actually to the definition of One Health. And the One Health High-Level Expert Panel, when we were established in 2021, we rewrote the One Health definition and we actually published it, and there were specific reasons for that because all the definitions were very much focused on specific aspects, and we really thought there was a need for a One Health definition that's really including all the definitions out there. And I'm going to go through some of that because I think as I go through it, it will link to what we need to do with the SDGs, specifically with health, but also with education. And how we can maybe look at implementation, the synergies, and also the linkages. So if you look at the One Health definition of OLAP, it is, some of it is familiar to you. It's One Health is an integrative, unifying approach that aims to sustainably balance, and that word is actually quite important, and optimize the health, not just of people, but also of animals and the ecosystem. So it's really looking at this holistic approach and try to move away from an anthropogenic approach. It also really recognized that the health of humans, animals, and here we include domestic and wild animals, we include plants, we include the wider environment, are closely linked and interdependent. And I think with the pandemic going on during the past few years, we realized that this is really important. What is also important about this approach is that it mobilized multiple sectors and disciplines. And this is something that we know with the One Health approach before, but what's included in this definition that's really important is communities at varying levels of society, really to work together, not just to see if there's disease or not disease, but really we're using the word well-being. And then the last part of this definition is actually really important. While we're doing this, we're also tackling other threats like the collective need for clean water, energy and air, safe and nutritious food, climate change, and contributing to sustainable development. So a One Health approach is really a holistic approach that can bring all of this together. What's quite important also with our definition is that there's certain underlying principles that we also published. And one of them is equity. And this is between sectors, between disciplines, between communities. It's really important. Socio-political parity, where we really look at all people as equal and deserving equal rights and opportunities. And this is where it becomes really important in approaches going forward, where we include the voices of communities and marginalized voices in the conversations. Socio-ecological equilibrium is really important, where we need to look at the balance between human, animal, and environmental interaction, and really recognizing biodiversity. COP15 were just mentioned. You know, this is really important that we address biodiversity also following a holistic approach. It's also about efficient, sufficient space and resources, and that everything really have a value in the ecosystem. That is really important. It's also about humans having to adopt sustainable solutions and recognize that we are responsible for the well-being of future generations. And then it's all also about transdisciplinarity and multi-sectoral collaboration. And this is also why we're having this discussion today, where all disciplines need to be around the table. But it's not just the traditional disciplines. It's also things like modern and traditional forms of knowledge and a broad representation of perspectives going forward. And I think some of these things didn't really happen in past conversations. And it's really important if we want to make a difference going forward and addressing some of these sustainability goals that we also address this. There's some practical things out there. The Quadripartite released the One Health Joint Plan of Action in October. That is a very broad level plan of how to bring all of these things together. It's going to be followed by implementation plan and tools. So it's becoming more practical. It's not just talk and documents. It's really moving towards a direction where it needs to be implemented on the ground. And there's some guidance on a global level on how to do that regionally and on national levels. If you look at the action plan, it includes things like enhancing One Health capacities. That goes back to education, really building a correct workforce that can address these issues from a multi and transdisciplinary nature. And that goes back to education on school level, practitioners, communities. There's just so many levels where that needs to happen. It's not just about pandemics. We should also recognize other diseases, endemic and neglected diseases. We need to remember AMR, antimicrobial resistance. We need to include all food safety and food system issues. It needs to include the environment. So there's a whole track bringing the environment into this picture, something that's been really neglected in the past. And if we really talk about well-being and health for all, we need to strengthen the environment in this picture, not just have an anthropogenic approach, but become more cosmocentric and really include everything in this approach. So I think I didn't time myself, but I think I'll stop there, and then I'm welcome to take some questions also later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mercator. Especially for your valuable insights and overview of the One Health approach, its different aspects and how it could be valuable achieving a sustainability. Okay, I will now give the floor to Mr. Londre Egbende. Londre, in light of the exemplary workshops that you and co-authors undertook with stakeholders in the DRC to assess interlinkages between health and the SDGs, We would love to hear your thoughts on ways to enable integrated approaches.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for this opportunity for speaking in this forum. So I would share our experience during the today's workshop that we organized in DRC to assess the interlinkage between SDG 3, health and well-being, and other SDG in the context of TRC. So, you know, in the country, so a systematic and contextualized assessment of the interactions between SDG and health is lacking. So we aim to organize and classify the linkages between SDG in DRC with a focus on health and well-being for a multi-sectoral platform. So we brought together, we organized a two-day workshop with 35 experts. We tried to have this multi-sectoral platform. So we took seven from academia, one from private sectors, four from civil society organizations, and six from international NGOs. So we organized them in five groups. So in each group, we have each group has a task to assess three or four SDG. And we try to have in each group people working according to their field of work. For instance, SDG 1, 2, 3 were assessed by a medical doctor, an agronomist. We try to make in the group people in the area or SDG for whom they are contributing for. So during our workshop, we found that progress on SDGs 3 was perceived as promoting progress on most SDGs, but it was moderately. It was not strong. But when taking into account a second order interaction, so we have a positive feedback loop was identified. So we know that if we put a lot of efforts on SDG 3, we can achieve other SDGs. So in our workshop, we recognize that it's imperative to set up structures, bringing together different sectors to accelerate work towards achieving the 2030 agenda. You know, in the country, there isn't these kinds of multi-sectoral platforms. So we recommend to our government to put to set up this multi-sectoral platform. And now I would like to inform you that our recommendation has been addressed because now there is a launching of this multi-sectoral platform led by our prime minister. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. It was a very valuable contribution. Really interesting to hear about these workshops that you ran in the DRC and how practical they were, how we can bring in different stakeholders to help us understand the linkages that are relevant in particular context. And maybe in the future, use this then to build partnerships to develop an integrated approach. Thank you very much. Okay, I will now cede the floor to Dr. Katie Pelican. Katie, in the context of your very considerable expertise in One Health and leading role in SDG initiatives at University of Minnesota, we look forward to hearing your recommendations.
Thank you so much, David. And it's exciting to hear about all the good work that's happening all over the world and all the people that are joining from all over the world. So I feel like we're a global community. I'm a wildlife veterinarian who spent 10 years, now going on 15 years, supporting global One Health programs and have had the opportunity to co-lead the SDG initiative at the university. And I find many parallels and synergies among these efforts, although they're not as aligned as I think they should be. One Health, as Dr. Mark Hutter talked about, is defined as a collaborative approach to addressing health challenges that are rising at the interface of animals, humans, and the environment. Like pandemics, climate change, pollution, biodiversity loss, I have the Speex macaw behind me. They were declared extinct in the wild in 2019. There's been a global One Health movement that has sought to strengthen the multi-sectoral systems needed to address these threats, and has in part been implemented under a wide variety of frameworks, the Global Health Security Agenda, which involved more than 50 countries, the World Health Organization, international health regulations, the tripartite zoonotic disease guide, and I'm most excited in many ways about the work with the quadripartite, which has now included UNEP, in addition to WHO, FAO, and the World Organization for Animal Health. And with that, a suite of tools that have been developed under the tripartite zoonotic disease guide and now the joint plan of action. This has allowed these frameworks, I think, these collaborations at the highest level and throughout the system have allowed funders and implementing actors like USAID, ASEAN, African Union, WHO, the intergovernmentals, World Bank, to align efforts to strengthen coordination and collaboration across sectors at different levels of society under national health security action plans and national antimicrobial resistance action plans and other. So we're sort of creating these plans and working down. My contributions to this effort have been through two approaches. I've done a lot of work with workforce strengthening, which of course cuts across our two topics today, which I led a USAID program to strengthen workforce by working with 97 universities in 17 countries, working on multidisciplinary competency-based experiential training programs to support students actually going out and doing One Health together and supporting the development of a variety of competency, global competency frameworks, including the WHO IHR National Focal Point that we embedded a lot of One Health work in that, some One Health frameworks, competency frameworks. We've worked with FAO on field-based One Health informed wildlife field EPI training, as well as now working with the FAO to create a wildlife and biodiversity version of that field EPI training. I've also, as mentioned, co-developed with USDA a tool called OSMART, One Health Systems Mapping and Analysis Resource Toolkit. And with that have looked at supported governments to strengthen multi-sectoral systems in their countries in 20 different countries. This is a tool that's recommended under the Tripartite Zoonotic Disease Guide and supports basically participatory collaborative decision-making among different agencies to improve how they coordinate and collaborate. And we've used that at the intergovernmental level with like the Arctic Council and all the circumpolar countries collaborating together, all the way down to working with indigenous communities, doing that with a community here in Minnesota, working on food sovereignty issues and a wide variety of topics under One Health, like climate change resilience, a lot of work on infectious disease that was its original use. So I would say the lessons learned from that body of work are that first, we are a species, even though we're a social species, we're pretty bad at formalized systems for collaboration. We silo our systems a lot, but we do collaborate a lot and in a very ad hoc way. So we have a lot of connections where they're just not very formalized. And we see that both in SDGs and in Global Health Security Agenda and other One Health efforts across the globe, that SDGs could learn from some of the work, I think, of the One Health community, and that the One Health community has done in creating more formalized alignments and coordination mechanisms. We talked about the plan of action that's at the intergovernmental level. There's these national action plans, and we've done that. And then all the way down to institutional level, working with universities, working with government agencies. And I think One Health could learn from the fully integrated framework that the SDGs represent. I think One Health has moved in that direction, but I think we could do more even. As Dr. Marcotter discussed, I think there's tremendous power in recognizing the importance of both the social and environmental goals in everything we do. And at University of Minnesota, we've actually started using the SDGs as a tool for thinking about challenges in a systems-based way and applied it to things like food and water and actually cancer and emergency response. Because you need to think about all these things. You need to think about climate change and poverty and others if you want to really address these issues. So really moving away from this sort of agriculture, human health, and now sort of trying to get environment on to really thinking about it as a system. I think we all need to do better. Both One Health and SDGs have really struggled with getting down to the front line and local implementation of these efforts. I think we should collaborate more on those things, you know, county, provincial, community. I think this is weak across the board. And then the last one I would say is that I do think universities can play a key role in fostering local implementation and convening the sectors needed to make progress, represent all that diversity. They train a lot of the people that are working in countries, and I think they're often overlooked in terms of the role they could play. So that's actually the big role that we're trying to push forward with our initiative at the University of Minnesota. With that, I'll cede the floor.
Thank you very much, Katie. It's really interesting, very useful insights, and sounds like there's great opportunities for the SDG community and the One Health community to learn from each other and to create synergies across our different areas of work. It was nice too that you mentioned specific practical initiatives that we could do in terms of capacity building, training and practice, and also interesting to hear about the competency frameworks that exist there to help us on the way. Thank you very much. Okay, we will now take a closer look at education, and I will cede the floor to Ms. Elizabeth Moses Mullard. Elizabeth, given your strong advocacy for inclusive education in local communities in West Africa and the UK, and your exemplary work on giving voice to vulnerable groups, we will be grateful for your recommendations. Have we Elizabeth here with us? Here's hoping.
She's on mute, I think.
She's on mute. Unmute your phone.
I have done that now. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, David. And again, I say good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are. It is clear that we are now midway to our agreed deadline for achieving the 2030 agenda. And there is still a long way to go in terms of achieving SDG 4. And indeed, we do say that the COVID-19 pandemic, has caused reversal in global progress made on SDG 4 and across most of the SDGs. And that withstanding, we cannot deny that, firstly, the pandemic only exacerbated the already marked, though unacceptable, inequalities that exist within and among countries in relation to ensuring that children and young people globally enjoy their right to education through the provision of inclusive and equitable quality education and lifelong learning opportunities for all. Secondly, we can say that the COVID-19 pandemic has helped us to better understand the interactions and trade-offs between and among SDGs, for instance, how the social safety net enjoyed by children from low-income households who are in formal education, such as free school meal, has been helping to reduce the financial strain on their families, whilst also having a positive impact on reducing malnutrition and stunting in children. We also witnessed how access to remote learning in the throes of the pandemic was near impossible in countries with poor access to digital technologies and stable power supply, or how in countries with shortage of clean water resources, schools had to close earlier and for longer periods in order to contain the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Thirdly, we can say that the pandemic is actually helping us to develop more resilient and systems thinking responses to global problems, which can form a strong backbone for the important choices that we would need to make in this half-term period if we must meet up with the 2030, with our 2030 deadline. to make a more specific, to take a more specific analytical view of the particular situation of countries that we work with in Western Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, particularly least developed countries, and their progress against SDG 4. These countries, which LDCs are about a quarter of the UN member states, and they make up about 13.8% of global population. 33 out of 47 of the LDCs are in Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, to be more geographically specific. Interestingly, as noted, according to Worldometer, if you look at the statistics on COVID-19 impact, only about 1.7% of fatalities were recorded in LDCs, of COVID-19 fatalities were recorded in LDCs. So we might say that COVID-19 is a problem, actually posed a problem for LDCs, right? It was another problem to grapple with, but we knew according to that, the UNICEF data pre-COVID, that children in LDCs accounted for 1 out of 3 of cases of out-of-school children and young people. So to add to children and young people with lack of access to quality education would even increase the figures. So it is perhaps more apt that in most of these countries, there are other issues that affect children and make it difficult for us to achieve SDG 4. Conflicts remain one major issue in these countries, and also climate-related crises also pose far greater risk for achieving SDG 4 than the COVID-19. So what have we been doing? We are, as Alpha Zulu advocates, we are making efforts to try to bring local stakeholders, you know, into the discussion, because international frameworks and agreements and discussions can be very complex for people at the grassroots level to understand. And the SDGs, they have to be localized, so they are more local. We also find that in this region, public education, which is supposed to be the major responsibility of government, is more often has been given up to non-state actors, to non-government actors. So we find more of private schooling than public schooling. So, and this also affects regulations and the standard and the quality of education that children in this region achieve. Even though it, at least to an extent, they help to make sure that, look, children are having education, children are being educated, but the standard of education is poor compared to the counterparts in more advanced, more developed countries, or where there is actually, there's more of government support, government intervention in the education sector, or where there is more of funding from government to aid the education sector. So we are engaging with people at the local level to get their to make sure that their voice is heard, because education is a human right. So it is important that those who are the rights holders get to talk about those things that are important to them, and those how they are affected. For instance, it is possible to...
Sorry to interrupt, Elizabeth. I'm just conscious that we're running short on time, and I just want to, I would like to move to the next speaker. But before I do that, I want to thank you very much for your intervention. especially for highlighting the impact of the pandemic on vulnerable groups, and for drawing all these connections across the goals in terms of transformative actions that we need to do to really holistically address these challenges. Thinking here of what you mentioned about free school meals, SDG 2, access to digital technology, SDGs 9 and 17, stable power supplies, SDG 7, peace, SDG 16, climate action, SDG 13. And I think that's a great contribution that you have made. And also the importance of localizing the SDGs and giving voice to vulnerable groups and civil society in education planning, and particularly in the European environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I will now give the floor to Professor Victoria Thorson. Victoria, in light of your vast experience in sustainable development education, curriculum design, and value-based education, as well as your notable work in this area for UNESCO, UNEP, and the EU, we will be grateful for your recommendations.
Thank you very much. Welcome to everyone. You know, the SDG 4 targets and indicators deal with issues that are undeniably urgent and necessary. As Elizabeth mentioned, this is very important for people all over the world, especially in light of the growing literacy poverty which we are recognizing. And literacy poverty also is about the number of children and youth who cannot read and write, even though they go to school. The issues of government expenditure on education, universal pre-primary and primary and secondary education, equal access, as we've been talking about, effective learning environments, and the need for more teachers. These targets are essential, but they're primarily concerned with practical, measurable adjustments to education as it's provided today. And we know that education today is not giving us or not leading to sustainable development. But fortunately, as Jan Gustav mentioned in his introduction, SDG 4 is also about quality education, and inclusive quality education is something which is being demanded by educators, parents, youth, politicians, and the private sector and others all around the world. In other words, this demand has been reiterated by stakeholders working together in networks such as the UNESCO ESD for 2030 network, its predecessor, the Global Action Plan Partner Network. Their research and experience, as well as that of many others around the globe, indicate that this new form of education that's needed has to be based on some very simple principles. The first one being that interconnectedness and interdependencies should frame pedagogy. This has been reflected on by several of the speakers already, that solidarity, compassion, ethics, and empathy should be ingrained in how one learns, and that cooperation and collaboration must be taught and practiced in appropriate ways at different levels and ages. And by doing that, we will achieve what we've referred to already here, these communities of practice, not just inside the schools, but with the communities outside of the schools as well. And then the principle that assessment should be aligned with these goals and should be aimed at helping the students to with their growth and their learning, rather than merely the assimilation and transmission of facts and skills. And the commitments to this kind of new education they've been coming around again and again, both for the new kind of education, the quality of it, as well as the practical targets to achieve that. I mean, we had the World Forum of Education in Berlin in 2021, partly online, but it was a great, participated by many leaders of education and ministers of education. Also recently at the Transforming Education Summit that was held at the UN in connection with the General Assembly. But despite this flow of commitments, of documents, of proclamations, we still have a long way to go. And I would suggest a number of things that can perhaps help hasten the progress. One is, as Jan Gustav mentioned, promises must have been made, but they have to be kept. In other words, political will and leadership have to be expressed, done by the leaders. They have to be willing to implement the commitments that have already been made. Words and signatures are not enough. Leaders have to be held to account for their commitments, and that's something we can all participate in. And then there's the wider recognition that has to be fostered of the fundamental purpose and power of education, which is namely to consult, to co-create knowledge, and to share in order to build a more united and just world. And to do so, we have to accept that learning is, in fact, a process of wondering, of wandering, of caring, and of daring, rather than absorbing more information. But this means that we need to focus more on the socio-emotional dimensions of education, as well as the cognitive part, so that learners will not just feel obligated to contributing to sustainable development, but want to do so. And finally, the fact that education has to be, as with the other Agenda 2030 goals, it needs to keep in sight the long-term as well as the immediate welfare of the community it's meant to serve. Contextuality and future thinking are essential. And there's no one-size-fits-all strategy, just as that's the case with all the SDGs, but it does require that we work together continuously to get a comprehensive and intensified systemic change in educational systems around the world. And by doing so, can help learners navigate uncertainty, help them take more responsibility to tend the planet and redefine prosperity. And perhaps that way we'll get education to beat at the heart of sustainability across all the SDGs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Victoria, for that great intervention. It was really interesting to, it was, I think, very important to remind us of the challenge of literacy poverty and how we need to double up our efforts to address that, but also for highlighting the importance of inclusive quality education. I thought it was interesting what you said about using linkages to frame the pedagogy and for giving us a much greater holistic sense of what quality education could be, not just being the facts and statistical skills, but the importance of imbuing a spirit of solidarity, empathy, collaboration, and daring. The need for a wider recognition of this across society. Many thanks for your contribution. Okay, I will now give the floor to Professor Lucia Saner Zhu. Lucia, given your significant work with the OECD on higher education, learning in school and the workplace, and your dedicated interest in raising SDG literacy, we would love to hear your thoughts on ways to account for interlinkages.
Thank you very much, David, for your introduction and invitation by also Irena for this very meaningful session. And I'm also particularly glad that I'm following up on Professor Victoria Torrenson. I can only sort of raise my hand and also agree to what she's proposed. And what I would like to do is to say something about the need for an alternative governance approach, so that what the proposals that she's making and emphasis that she mentioned could indeed be reality for all. And let's remember the SDG 4 is about ensuring inclusive and equitable quality education and promotion of lifelong learning opportunities for all. Of course, you know, if you look at the SDG report, the GSDR 2019, it was very demarcated and demonstrated that SDG is fundamental to the achievement of 2030 agenda. Therefore, good governance to ensure that we are, one is that we are, you know, sort of a tracking in terms of a different developments at different parts of the world or different parts of the system within a country or even a locality, but at the same time, building up the data necessary for continued improvement will be necessary. According to the UNESCO's 2018 report, we know that, you know, the funding for education and SDG 4 is way from sufficient. However, with the long impact of COVID as well as the inflation, that crisis that is going on, I think, you know, to expect more resources coming for the SDG 4 probably will be a hard ask. Nevertheless, we could do something within the sector to improve the delivery, the effectiveness, so that we continue to make progress toward SDG 4. So let me lay out, you know, some of the, you know, good reasons or the definition that we're using here in order to propose or to strike a more structured quality assurance approach to governance. Let me define the three factors. One is inclusive. I think, you know, inclusiveness we understood as access, coverage, and affordability for everybody, no matter rich or poor, or located at capital or remote area. That is a very big challenge. The second, what we understand as quality is relevance to citizenship, the labor force requirements, and lifelong learning capacities and curiosity. Without these characteristics, it is difficult to understand the concept of quality and also difficult to make a link between the SDG 4 about education and SDG 8 about decent work and economic growth and, you know, SDG 10 about, you know, inequality. And then the necessary condition to achieve the inclusiveness and quality will be the sufficient availability of qualified and committed teachers enabled by possibly by digital technology and also intergenerational cooperation and partnerships. So let me sort of unpack a little bit more within the limited time I have left. A responsive and effective governance system and related mechanism should capture the following. One, it is about participatory approach to stakeholder engagement in adjusting core curriculum to local context and labor market demands. And in this case, you know, to have a one curriculum at different, you know, schooling levels until sort of high school, and it is not sufficient. As we know, in many countries, even in the most advanced countries, not everybody going to university. So we need to address the employability, you know, right from the beginning. And, you know, based on data, we know that where most people are either continue to finish until high school and advance to the university and where it's not. The second, I think it is very important, as we see the education is not an aim by itself. And therefore, policy alignment between national educational program and national development plan, it will be necessary. That would allow voices, not only just the societal side, but it's also economic actors and employers. The third is, you know, we need to establish evidence-based adjustment to local context in order to engender confidence and also higher performance of the education delivery. Without that, you know, nobody's going to trust the local authorities and local schools to adjust their curriculum and still maintain a universal, you know, common core to allow students to advance. And the last one is, you know, to address the need for life, the future of work. And that means that, you know, competence developed today might not fit, you know, even 5 years from now. And how do we ensure lifelong learning that will demand a very important aspect of pedagogy that students are continue to be motivated and interested and curious about learning. Here, integrating technology could help, but we also know that almost half of the world population is still on the other side of the digital divide. And we have seen that very closely clearly during the pandemic. And therefore, we propose the intergenerational partnership for knowledge and knowledge sharing and transfer could be useful. Although it might be the older generation, not everyone have higher degree. Nevertheless, they have accumulated, many experiences and knowledge from their lived reality. And so a different level of schooling, their input could be useful. And here is, these are our 4 points about why we need to have a new approach to governance, and which will be based on quality assurance, clarity of process, and measuring of outcomes at the very end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lucia, for your important insights. Very grateful for to hear your thoughts, for highlighting the importance of lifelong learning and the need for greater funding in this area, especially in the context of the pandemic and the labor market disruptions that are arising from the digital transformation. It's very interesting to hear the idea of intergenerational collaboration and how we can use this for knowledge transfer and for achieving greater impact, and also the framework you outlined for delivering quality education is also very important. Thank you for your contribution. Okay, I will now give the floor to Dr. Karen. I will now give the floor to Mr. Angus McCabe. In the context of your very considerable work with UNITAR in helping countries to build the knowledge and skills necessary to achieve low carbon growth, climate change resilience, and a healthy environment, we look forward to hearing your recommendations.
Great. Thank you so much, David, and thanks for inviting me, which I might add you did with expert use of flattery, which always works, as we all know. So there's a skill that is obviously very effective and current. I might say that I am not an educator in the traditional sense, but at UNITAR, which is a principal training arm of the UN system, we do quite a number of training programs for policymakers, mainly amongst others. Very glad to be part of these dialogues because of the emphasis that they bring to what we might call the spaces in between the SDGs and the way that we're encouraged to look at linkages, both in terms of substance, but also the partnerships needed to work across SDGs. And I was reminded in a recent other dialogue that I attended, my work is mainly on climate change, green economy, as you said, David. We were reminded that policymakers deal with problems and not so much with disciplines, right? It's kind of catchy, but it's also profound because we know that the problems faced by countries are multifaceted, they're frequently messy, and they often result in political risks to resolving them. And I think I'm echoing quite a bit of what has already been said today, but we really do need to build the skills to be able to synthesize and interpret complexity. And often this is what countries most need in terms of support, as opposed to an overtly technical approach in a particular domain or a particular discipline. Now, in thinking about what I could say that might be of use today, I was actually rereading UNESCO's very good State of Education review of SDG 4, which was done earlier this year, which I believe contributed to the Transforming Education Summit in September. And one of the key messages in that report is about reimagining the education system. We've already heard quite a bit about what that might actually look like. And then when you look at it in a bit more detail, it talks about building an education system that provides learning and skills for life, for work, and for sustainable development. And it's this latter part, which is really where my experience comes in through the work that we do at UNITAR, and particularly a program called UN Climate Change Learn, which has been around for about a decade. So what are some of the things that we've learned that could be of value to this dialogue as we move forward to the SDG summit next year? And there's three that I'd like to share. Firstly, there needs to be a universal awareness and understanding of the planet upon which we live. Our economic system has provided many benefits globally, and I think it would be disingenuous not to recognize this. And yet, it is still a fundamentally unfair system that perpetuates inequity, and one that prioritizes certain parameters of economic success over others. And the result being the planet-killing externalities that we face today. I make no apologies for using that rhetoric, because as you summarized, Jan Gustav, in your comments, in the UNSG is equally direct and far more so in talking about many of these issues. Now, this is not about instilling fear in children and young adults about planetary catastrophe, but it is about giving them a real understanding of how our planet functions, whether this be in relation to the hydrological cycle, pollution loading, extinction of species, or indeed the carbon cycle. My generation, dare I say it, our generation, has not been sufficiently literate in any of these areas. It's been, frankly, a bit of a sideshow in our education. If you happen to prioritize geography or biology, you might know more about it. But it's not been enough. So one practical suggestion to bring to the SDG summit would be to significantly increase and improve education on how our planet works. So yes, we need the three R's, but foundation, perhaps the foundation upon which these stand could be a universal understanding of planet. Secondly, our education systems need to be repurposed towards building skills and problem analysis, drawing from multiple disciplines in doing so. And I think the last two speakers, Victoria, I think you talked about this, Licia, you also talked about this. In the area of climate change, for example, we talk a lot about building resilience, right? Economic, social, and physical, so that we can adapt. And this implies great complexity and heterogeneity from place to place. And one of the reasons I believe that financing for climate change adaptation lags so far behind financing for mitigation is the fact that we don't have enough trained minds in the system with the ability to interpret this complexity and define the sophisticated investments needed. In short, our education systems, formal, non-formal, are not up to the task of building resilience in the face of climate shocks and stresses, right? A practical way forward here, in my view, in UNITAR's experience, particularly in the area of training for professionals, is to rebalance our content towards softer skills, such as how to bring colleagues together around a table and get a result, how to inspire participation, how to build trust, and rather than to focus on technical disciplines. And I always quote here Salim al-Haq from Bangladesh, who's a leading thinker and actor on loss and damage. He's also an educator, and he says, content isn't really that important when it comes down to good training. And of course, he's being a little bit cute, but the point still needs to be made. Thirdly, and finally, if you'll allow me, David, I'd like to return to this language of reimagining in that UNESCO report, which I find poignant and powerful. Now, when you train, you never quite know what result you're going to get because it depends on the learner, right? It's an interaction, depends on their starting point. What are their aspirations? What is their reason for being in the room? So you don't know what you're going to get, but we know that the best trainings are those that engage the imagination of the learner. And perhaps we can go further, and somebody has already mentioned it. Perhaps we can, what we really should be doing is engaging the wonder of the learner, because a training space is a safe space where you can do this, so that you can connect through to that innate ability that the human species possesses to solve complex problems. And it works quite simply because it's our creativity, right, that nourishes us more than anything else. Might call it the art that exists in the science. So let's recognize that if we really want to reimagine our education systems, we have to find ways to inject a sense of wonder back into it. And it does happen. And one way to do this on a personal level, and I'll just leave you with a thought, is to think, and do it now if you will humor me. Think about a teacher that most influenced you in your life. And in my experience, most of us can think about one or perhaps two, but rarely more than that. What's their name, right? What was it that that teacher said that means that you can instantly remember them right now as I'm speaking? What were their particular qualities? And drawing on much of what's been said today, can we reimagine an education system where those qualities that you're thinking about right now in that teacher are commonplace rather than scarce? Thank you, and let me hand back on that note.
Thank you very much, Angus, for your valuable contribution. Just to say it's all true. I just particularly liked how you challenged us to reimagine education to solve complex problems. And you outlined certain aspects of that, things such as increasing ecological content, the importance of softer skills to inspire participation, build trust and learn how to work across sectors, disciplines, and also importance in the, now that we're in the year of crisis, the importance of building skills in resilience. Thank you very much for your contribution. Okay, I will now give the floor to Dr. Karen Brown. Karen, in light of your leadership in SDG initiatives at University of Minnesota and with the Masters of Development Practice Program, we would love to hear your thoughts on the role that universities could play in accelerating implementation.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this important conversation about progress toward the SDGs. I'm really delighted to be here with this group of SDG leaders on the panel and in the audience. My own work focuses on education and research related to sustainable development and the SDGs. And in thinking about SDG 4 with its wide range of indicators, it really requires action at the local level by schools and local governments, national governments, as well as global institutions such as UNESCO. And all of these can help to drive progress on the inclusive access to and quality of education that the goal promotes. SDG 4.3 pertains particularly to equal access to higher education and looks at participation levels in institutions such as universities, colleges, vocational, and technical schools. And inclusive access to higher education is a crucial goal that has been made more challenging in the context of the global pandemic, as some of my colleagues on the panel have pointed out. But universities can play a much broader role in progress toward the SDGs and the 2030 Agenda in education, as well as in other areas. Universities often have capacities and resources that are distinct from other institutions. And I want to mention a few ways that I think universities can advance local and global progress on the SDGs. So I think universities can advance the really important goal that some of my colleagues have mentioned of local implementation of the SDGs in a couple of different ways. The first way is that universities can play a very important role in cross-sectoral convening. They can serve as platforms or hosts or conveners to build connections and facilitate local action that is multi-sectoral and integrative. Universities often have connections with local and national governments, with nonprofit sector organizations, and private sector entities. And these relationships can support relevant research and action to bring stakeholders together and understand how the needs and actions of each of these sectors influences the ability of other sectors to make progress on the goals. And we partnered, for example, with the Brookings Institution and the UN Foundation to convene a workshop of local Minnesota leaders across sectors in sustainable development to start a dialogue on how we can move forward local implementation. A second example of how universities can work toward local implementation has to do with connecting research and teaching resources and knowledge to local needs framed for the SDGs. So for example, at the University of Minnesota, we've worked with local groups of stakeholders from different sectors to map local needs and priorities for issues such as clean water access and food security to the SDGs. At the same time, we map our own research to the SDGs. And in that way, university researchers can identify gaps, knowledge gaps that they can fill with their research to support progress toward the goals. We're also working with local governments in Minnesota to identify gaps in water research specifically that, if filled, can advance local priorities and needs on inclusive clean water access. And we're also partnering with the SDG Data Alliance to create a local data hub with local metrics related to the SDGs. So in all of these ways, the university can help to drive local implementation and progress toward the goals. And I think universities can also have broader impacts in progress toward Agenda 2030 in a couple of different ways. First, universities can partner globally in networks and build communities of practice that can help to advance the SDGs. I'll give a couple of examples of the work that we've done. The University of Minnesota partners with the European Aurora Network of Research Universities, and there we share approaches to how we can leverage our curriculum and our research toward SDG progress. How can we understand research conducted by university researchers in terms of the SDGs, and how can it support that progress? How can we make educational opportunities on the SDGs available to our students? And one example of that is curriculum mapping to the SDGs so students can identify these opportunities. Another example is our partnership with the Master of Development Practice Global Network, which is a network in all regions of the world of universities offering master's programs in sustainable development practice. And these universities all work together and learn from each other on how best to educate students to be leaders in the sustainable development space. And that leads me to my fourth and last point, which is universities can support progress and accelerate progress toward the goals related to SDG 4.7, Education for Sustainable Development and Global Citizenship. I think universities have a central role to play in education for SDG leadership. Strong sustainable development leaders will have a set of skills and perspectives that support SDG progress. And my colleagues have mentioned a couple of these perspectives, integrative or systems thinking to understand the synergies and the trade-offs between the goals, multi-sectoral or multi-stakeholder skills, and a local to global perspective to see the potential for local implementation to drive global progress. So we do things like offer small grants to student organizations to support their own innovative SDG education activities. And we also offer a set of broad sustainable development education programs to provide the necessary skills and knowledge that my colleagues have noted. So these are just a few of the ways that universities can work with partners across sectors to help move us forward on achieving the SDGs. I've learned a lot from listening to my colleagues today. I thank you, and I cede the floor.
Thank you very much, Karen. That was really great, especially for highlighting the role that universities can play in cross-sectoral convening, how universities could leverage their existing relationships to really bring that forward. And it was also very interesting to hear about different cases you have in your university in the areas of, for example, working with the local authorities on water governance, the data hubs that you also mentioned, the work you're doing on curriculum mapping, and also the importance of building capacity for leadership on the SDGs more broadly in society. Thank you very much. And now I will pass the floor to Mr. Brad Olson, who has been very patiently waiting in the sidelines. Brad, the floor is yours. In light of your research and policy around the scaling of educational innovations for systemic improvement in low and middle income countries, we will be grateful for your recommendations.
Thank you very much. I think I'll articulate three problems in global education development, suggest three ways forward, and then leave on a possible note of hope. I work at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and I lead a GPE and IDRC-funded education development project called ROSI. It's a multi-year, multi-country education initiative in which my team and I have been studying alongside 15 regional and global teams who are working to implement and research promising education innovations in 30 low and middle income countries. Each team's goal is to embed its own promising education innovation for lasting use in one or more countries. Essentially, that's what we might call education innovation scaling for impact. One primary problem in education development is that although access to education has increased globally, the quality of learning opportunities has not. A second primary problem is that there's too much fragmentation among groups and education solutions. And a third primary problem is the dominance of a short-term project mentality. In other words, lots of single-point education solutions that are developed, piloted, implemented, and then soon run out of money and left to fend for themselves. Instead, I believe there's a need for education innovation scaling, systems transformation, and an honest restructuring of the whole incentive ecosystem around lasting educational improvement. And having been studying educational improvement in these 30 low and middle income countries for a few years now, I really think that there are three particular things that we might consider implementing as we move forward. One of them is we should focus our global trends and all of these multilateral organizations and expert partnerships with an emphasis on learning about local needs and local expertise and working to build those out and bolster them rather than import and implement educational interventions from an increasingly narrowed global list of education solutions. I believe that going too far in either direction risks errors. Local efforts without the benefits of global expertise and experience is myopic. But simply applying global solutions to local contexts is arrogant and neglects the crucial value of local needs, local expertise, and local action. Secondly, I think we should leverage the power of research and data sharing around equity issues. This means strengthening educational data collection and analysis systems in countries, offering capacity strengthening on how in-country data professionals can analyze and use the collected data, and incentivizing the disaggregation of data for tracking equity progress in order to find out who is benefiting and who is being neglected in the education efforts being scaled. When research can highlight and talk about equity concerns, equity issues can move past mere platitudes into real action. And not just around rural education and gender equity, although those two areas are incredibly important, but also around accommodating learning disabilities and differences in a robust way, and attention to ethnic minorities, religious freedom, and LGBTQIA issues. The third way forward I recommend is that I believe there's a need to bring all stakeholders together for honest and candid conversations about how to restructure the incentive system within which all of us operate. This is because it's difficult to organize and act for long-term embeddedness of an education innovation when the incentives are not aligned. Governments and bureaucracies speak of long-term impact, but electoral politics are structured for short-term project implementation. The donor community still often funds single innovations for short-term implementation. And the fields within which we work still believe that there are silver bullets on the horizon, whether it's ed tech or lowering requirements for teacher certification. I think education improvement is more complex than that. And so my final sort of thought, and I'd like to think of this as a note of hope, is that there may be some real optimism around systems transformation. The optimist in me sees hope in pursuing education scaling and systems transformation as complementary aims. Systems transformation can be a conceptual framework through which multiple stakeholders, policymakers, funders, and educationalists can come together and discuss and establish consensus on the primary purposes of education in their location, then identify all of the levers and components of their location's educational ecosystem, and then work together to align the key levers, change out the faulty parts or unsuccessful linkages with healthier, more functional ones, always keeping children and their families and communities as the core priority. And in a holistic way, properly fund, adjust, track, and increase system capacity for the whole machinery of the education system in that location. The optimist in me believes this is possible. The cynic in me worries that this might become the next half-baked fad in a list that's very long of well-intentioned ideas that crumple under the weight of fragmentation, prioritizing short-term surface fixes, and political squabbling. I hope that doesn't happen. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Brad, for that valuable and insightful contribution, particularly regarding for highlighting the problem of fragmentation that exists across the, with all of the different projects, and particularly like the idea that you were getting across was of the need for a partnership between global expertise and local efforts. And that, of course, has to prioritize vulnerable groups and achieve equity. I think it's also important, an issue in universities as well, but throughout the education system, is the need to restructure incentive systems, for example, to enable integrated approaches, to allow for outreach, to allow for engagement. Thank you very much for your contribution. Okay, we will now hear a reflection by Gervais and Zoa, who is a development specialist and coordinator of the CALDS and former member of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Gervais, the floor is yours.
Thank you to give me the floor, dear David. Hello to everyone. As a contribution to be practical for the implementation of the AG3 and AG4, I suggest to formulate a working planning with the partner, state member, UN agency, NGO, civil society at local, regional, and international level. Regarding the SGF3, matrix of the working planning can be 1, activity, 2, objective, result, indicator, method, and tool of verification, period, party, budget, and logistics. Element of component SG3 can be, we can have target 3-1, 3-2, 3-3, 3-4, 3-5, 3-6, 3-7, 3-8, 3-9. Regarding SG4, element of the matrix can be activity, result, indicator, method, and tool of verification, period, party, budget, and logical. Element of component can be, we can have target 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, 4-4, 4-5, 4-6, 4-7. The result of the working plan, the result of the working planning can be a tool of the focus during the SG summit with state member, UN agency, NGO, civil society. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Gervais, for this insightful reflection. I will now open the floor to questions and answers. If we have time, I will just ask the speakers to maybe we have time for one question and a 30-second response from everyone. So I would just ask everybody to turn on their cameras and to unmute themselves. Okay, so we covered a lot of ground today, and I think we heard a lot of everyone approached the problem from their in a particular particular way, and we heard a lot of very interesting recommendations, which if you put them all together, I think we start to build up a picture of what needs to be done. So just to conclude, you know, we all know that we're not on track to achieve the goals. We also know that we've entered this era prices where progress is going to be harder to achieve and maintain. Based on your vast knowledge and experience and your contribution today, in 30 seconds, please could you summarize what you think really needs to be done to drive implementation and achieve integrated approach? So who would like to go first with that?
I'll go.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I still maintain that COVID-19 is not the major reason why about 47 countries of the least development, 47 least development countries have not really progressed on SDG 4. There are other issues that we need to look at beyond COVID-19. Quite all right, in terms of COVID-19, we need to be more prepared for future pandemics and, you know, such crises like the COVID pandemic that we had. And but we need to look at other areas where the problems are. Governments need to take greater responsibility. There needs to be more funding, and also more developed countries and the richer countries need to look at how they can help these poorer countries and these least developed countries to achieve their plans for SDG 4. So this we need to do. And we also need to ensure that we are engaging all stakeholders. We need to build trust to achieve SDG 4. This is important. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. Who would like to go next?
I can jump in, David. So I would say, you know, one of the most important things to advance progress is to connect the global framework to local implementation on the ground. And I think a number of us have talked about how important that is. And so I think drawing on and convening across all sectors to make progress at the local level and to see how local needs and priorities fit with this global framework is absolutely crucial toward progress toward the goals. And I think institutions like universities, but many others can play an important role in facilitating that local implementation.
Thanks for that, Katie. Would anyone like to follow that up?
Yeah, I can follow that up. I think it's very essential that we share our experiences, that we build networks, that we don't let the whole idea of education in particular or health become something that belongs to the experts. You know, after the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, were finished, education was hardly on the table. It was so, you know, some of us were afraid we weren't even going to get a sustainable development goal on education because there was very little focus on that. We need to share our experiences, to help each other, involve other people. And like I said in my presentation, that's not an easy thing. You know, learning how to listen and to consult and also to dare to have these ideas and hope that we can create something new in all parts of the world, not just in our own backyard, but in the countries that need it, different things than what we need. But working together, we might achieve.
Thank you, Victoria. Anyone like to follow that up?
Yes, I will jump. Thank you, David. So for me, all SDGs are very important, as well as SDG 3 and SDG 4. But we need to work together for a multi-sectoral platform if we want to achieve the 2030 agenda. So most recommendation will be to set up this sort of platform in each country. Each sector needs to work with other sectors for achieving the SDG. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Londre. Is there anyone who would like to add to that?
Yeah, let me add just a reflection, if I may. I don't want to try and sort of synthesize, but I just listening to the discussion today is very helpful. I was reflecting on the One Health approach presented by Wanda, and I think also Katie spoke about it. This is an area I know less about, so it's the bit that I find most interesting. And again, I thought it was fascinating to hear you talk about health in a very multidisciplinary way, and also that there are different types of knowledge and learning needed. But then I was also struck by the number of times in which the One Health work was being aligned or linked with biodiversity, right? And I just, you know, I think this is an example of the sorts of thinking that we need to do. I wouldn't have thought that this is a link that you would make, but it's so obvious and it's so clear. And I just wanted to thank you for making that, drawing that relationship. It's an example of the way in which we've all got to start thinking laterally and, you know, horizontally. And so I just wanted to raise that as an important thing that I've learned. Thank you. Back to you, David.
Thank you. Anyone like to add a final remark?
Yeah, if I just can say a few words very quickly. I think one of the issue with the education sector, because we have done many work, you know, not only for governments, but also with enterprises. What we have noticed that when it comes to education and continued learning, you know, we need to somehow make a case for the demand. Demand is why and what, and how and when. And I think, you know, there is a tendency to see education as a standalone sector, even though we do talk about a sort of interdisciplinary approach, but that is about the content. We do not look at the relationships with other stakeholders, which is, you know, the state needs to have national development, improving of productivity, also facing, you know, many of the sort of impeding or impending crisis. But also enterprises, they need to have good, productive, disciplined workforce. And individuals, they need to have sustainable livelihood. So we need to bring all these economic dimensions into the story, into the picture. And then we will start to have somewhat, you know, a more extended conversation about what we can do by achieving SDG 4. And so there will be, you know, a higher demand. You know, at this moment, you know, it is unthinkable and unconscionable to have so many highly educated youngsters in developing countries as well as in developed countries are not able to have a gainful life for their own, you know, for themselves and for their family. And so I think, you know, when we reimagine what education can do and need to do, we need to strengthen and heighten these other voices. So far has not been very strong in terms of how we go about our own business of educating the future generations. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Lucia. Anyone for one final remark?
I would just say, similar to what others have said though, but is, you know, we need to get better at integrating our approaches, and that's horizontally and vertically. You know, we talked about local implementation. You know, there was a question that I answered, but said, you know, oh, SDG 3 is health, that's human health. No, it's not human health. We can't think about, you know, childhood mortality without thinking about all the SDGs. It has to do with climate change. It has to do with biodiversity. It has to do with poverty. And that's, I mean, it has to do with anything One Health is talking about also. So, you know, and that means both formalized and informal to me. You know, we need both grassroots. We need to draw on indigenous knowledge, as someone mentioned, but also create these formalized systems. And I think One Health has maybe done a little bit better at that, you know, formalized collaborations, systems that integrate. And so, you know, that's what I would say is I think we have some things to learn from each other. And, you know, all the way from the funders and the intergovernmentals all the way down to the community level, we need to be more integrated in how we're thinking and acting to achieve these.
Thank you very much, Katie. I fully agree. We need to systemize learning on how to work together across boundaries. We need to incentivize it, bring it across all sectors of society. Okay, There are a lot of really interesting comments and questions in the Q&A, and I sincerely regret that we won't get around to them today. Just to conclude, I want to thank everyone for participating. It was a very fruitful discussion, and I hope everyone has a safe and peaceful holiday season, and I'll hand it over now to Irina for closing remarks.
Well, thank you, David. I'm not Irina, as you all can see. Irina had to go to a meeting at the UN, and she asked me kindly to read what she had prepared as a closing statement. Let me just first say one thing, because I've been in this game all my life. We know that MDGs made lots of progress, despite what critical people will say. Back in 2013, I was discussing with a friend of mine, very well-known person in Norway, also engaged in politics of environment, sustainable development and security. And he told me that I should shut down and not talk so much about the SDGs, because that's not where things were going to be happening in the future. Well, I think today's discussion and panel has proved him wrong. I also think that whatever we are doing with the SDGs every year has proved such a sentiment wrong. Today, I heard more information and I got to learn more things that I think that's also reflected in all the questions and comments that we have seen. I have heard interlinked, I have heard integrated, indivisible, I have heard the need to localize, I have heard multi-stakeholderism, I heard that research can be an incubator, and the university certainly can be. Reimagine has been a word that's kept repeating, and also, of course, to my heart, hope. And also the fact that health reaches all the SDGs. We knew that in theory, and we now know it in practice as well. And we keep progressing better and faster, I think. There, Irina says that she sends, and so does Stakeholder Forum and our partners, a big thank to all our expert panel for delivering today's rich and thoughtful content. And as mentioned earlier in her introduction, the webinar has been recorded, and recording will be posted as a video and as an audio podcast on the Stakeholder Forum website very soon after this is over, and where you also have a recording of our first webinar. In addition, the Stakeholder Forum team will prepare a summary of this and future webinars for inputs to the United Nations SDG Summit in 2023. Lastly, we hope that you will join us on Thursday, the 26th of January in 2023, next year, for the third in the series of Countdown to the UN SDG Summit 2023. We will then highlight the SDGs 5 and 6, i.e. gender and water. We'll send you all this information soon. Until then, thank you so much. From all of us to all of you, have a happy Christmas. I hope that you can join in with people you would like.